Hope you had a lovely day off yesterday. I did. Okay, so day before yesterday, I told you a little bit about the history of the organism concept. And today is all about me trying to persuade you that I've got an answer, that I've sorted it all out. So let's see how we go. I'm going to start off by saying just a couple of things about what philosophy of biology is. Just a couple of you have asked me, and I assume that plenty of you aren't really very familiar with it. So basically, philosophy can be all sorts of different things, which means philosophy of biology can be lots of different things. There are lots of different schools within it. The way I do it is called analytic philosophy, and it means that we do things like these, basically. So I don't mean to imply at all that these aren't things that biologists do. These are things that biologists do all the time. In fact, there isn't really a sharp boundary between philosophy of biology and theoretical biology. The main difference really is just that biologists learn biology first, and they pick these ideas or habits up unconsciously, usually, whereas philosophers learn these kind of rules of thinking, these disciplines first, then they try and learn biology. So these are kind of at the front of my mind all the time, whereas they're hopefully at the back of yours. So today, basically, I'm going to do some philosophy for you, which means I'm going to present you with an argument. It's essentially a unificatory argument. So as such, it rests on an underlying assumption about science, which is roughly that a theory or concept which is able to unify two or more other theories or concepts is better. It has greater weight than either of them are alone, or it's a better guide to truth, you might say. So basically, we think it's a good thing. What was specific? I just listed some things that are the sorts of things that we do.
But that you could say is something which is fair for any member, nothing.
That's what I said. I said biologists do these, but they don't usually have explicit schooling in them, whereas a philosopher's education is in these first, and then later on you might go and try and learn biology or something and apply these things to it explicitly. Is that fair? Yes? No, I think good scientists do all of these, but they don't usually have formal lessons in them, like perhaps they could do. So I was just explaining a little bit about what sort of argument you can expect today. So it's basically unificatory. So I think we usually think that it's a good thing if we can account for multiple theories within a single sort of overarching theory. One thing philosophers might do is try and kind of evaluate the basis for that assumption, try and give reasons why it's a good principle to adopt or not. I'm not going to go into that today. It basically comes from an assumption about unity in science, but I'm just going to presuppose it for today and basically just get on with telling you about the problem that I'm trying to solve. Okay, so this is a quote from a philosopher, just expressing the simplest form of the problem. So there are two components to this claim, basically. Firstly, biology needs a clear organism concept, and secondly, that it doesn't currently have one. So this quote from a biologist this time, sort of, begins to tell us something about why we need an organism concept. So the general idea is that organismality just strikes us as a brute fact about reality. So one way you might say it is just that living stuff is lumpy. It doesn't appear to us as a sort of homogeneous soup, but it's instead arranged into groups and lumps. And it's arranged into lumps in ways that sometimes seems to affect the way that it behaves. So this slide is just intended to show you that we don't currently have a clear organism concept and that we don't have a consensus. So in fact, we have a somewhat excessive multitude of competing definitions. These are all trying to name sort of necessary properties of individual organisms. It's not meant to be exhaustive. I've just put some names up there to show you that I didn't make them up, basically. Sorry? This is just to show you that there are lots and lots of competing definitions of the organism out there. Each word in big font is naming, is a property that someone has declared is the essential property of an organism. And they're all different. And I sort of touched on this yesterday. The other point is that there are some cases in which this multiplicity of different definitions leads to some conflict amongst biologists about what to do, about the right way to carry out their demography. mentioned yesterday, they've actually got a choice about which hierarchical scale they want to count at to carry out fitness surveys. So a question worth asking at this stage is just what would solving the organism problem actually mean? What would a solution involve? So again, something that philosophers say is that defining a concept means giving necessary and sufficient conditions for membership of the class. So there's a class, individual organism, we want to name some properties which enable us to decide unambiguously for any given object that we see whether or not it is an individual organism. We have another principle which, again, I'm just going to assume for today, which is that scientific concepts in particular really ought to be defined in terms of the role that they're playing within scientific theory. So there are arguments for this, but again, I'm not going to go into it. So putting these together, basically what it would mean for me to solve the organism problem is just to say what it is about organisms that enable them to play the role that they're expected to play in biological science, to say how they're able to do that. Okay, so there are lots of different things you might say about the functions that the organism concept plays in biology. I'm just going to pull out a few as especially significant.
Can I just interrupt?
Sure.
When you say concept, it could equally well refer to relations between classes. It would be exactly defining necessary and sufficient conditions for being
there. So you think organismality could instead be a relation? Well, it's usually a one-place property, right? We say that there's one thing as the property of being an organism rather than it being a relationship between two things.
I just wanted to make a comment. We can discuss.
Okay.
Not life,
an organism.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And I think most technicians, you will have to rely on a comparison of what is inside your concept and what is outside. So defining relationships between the two is difficult to avoid.
Okay, well, why don't you tell me how you think of the job I've done by the end? Yeah? Why don't you let me get to the end and then tell me what you think of the job I've done doing it this way? Okay, so this is an important job that I'm supposing that the concept is doing in biological science. So we use the organism as a sort of bookkeeping unit. And basically this is kind of like a motto of mine. We know that by counting some lumps and not others, i.e. by counting organisms, that we can construct predictive and explanatory models about how those objects are going to change over time under the action of natural selection. We also know, however, that we can't get this result by counting just any old object. So basically, we do know that some objects in the compositional hierarchy just aren't relevant to our evolutionary models. So when a cow gets bigger, there's a sense the number of cells in its body increases, right? This implies that the number of gene copies that it's carrying increases. More cells, more copies of the genes. But we don't go around counting all these cells. We don't try to count all the copies of an allele that is in a cow. We ignore most of those genes and just count the cow once. Yeah? The trouble is that it's not always obvious which objects we can ignore in that way. So the idea is, it's not actually obvious whether we can ignore aspen trees in the same way. The idea is, we're not really sure whether an aspen grove expanding is the same sort of thing as a cow getting bigger or not. So, the first key thing I want to say about the concept is that it's supposed to guide us about what to count so that we can get the selective dynamics right and what we can ignore. Another thing is that we know that individuality is capable of shifting across hierarchical levels over evolutionary time. So we know that new levels of organismality have appeared in the past over evolutionary time. So any definition of the individual, it has to be the sort of thing which is able to transition, to shift to new levels over time. And the last point I make is that it needs to be a lineage general concept. It shouldn't be lineage specific. The idea is that if all living matter comes organised into these special lumps called organisms, then the concept should be able to deal with all these cases and any more that might turn up. Before we can talk about evolution, we need to be able to apply the concept of a generation to distinguish reproduction from growth and to tell the difference between an organism and a part of an organism and a colony of organisms. So, solving the organism problem for me involves finding answers to the following questions. Just what are the properties of organisms that enable them to support these evolutionary inferences? What happens when organismality shifts levels, as has happened during transitions in the past? And how can we work out what objects account when it's not obvious, and when we want, nonetheless, to apply the fitness of concept to build our evolutionary models? Okay. Am I talking slowly enough? Let me just check that. So, that was some sort of introduction. Here's what I'm going to try and do in the rest of the talk today. So first I'll explain a little bit to you about how those definitions that I just flashed up at the beginning, about how they're in conflict with one another. And then I'm going to show you how some of these definitions can be unified by reinterpreting them as identifying mechanisms with a shared functional role. And then finally I'm going to tell you why we ought to define the organism in terms of these mechanisms, of mechanisms that fill this role, and something about how this definition succeeds in answering those important questions about individuality. This is a little bit of a spoiler, a preview of my kind of overall unificatory scheme. So in part two, I'm going to be trying to persuade you that certain definitions are best understood as concerning mechanisms which force selection up to one level. So then after placing those definitions amongst the others, filling in the other boxes which answer different questions about how selection affects the entities at different hierarchical levels, then I'm going to try and persuade you that this first box is the one on which we ought to be focusing in order to define the organism. In other words, to name those properties that enable the concept to play that role that we're requiring of it. So if it goes too fast and you get completely lost and don't know what I'm talking about, these are the main things that I want to try and say today, so just remember these. So first of all, conflicting definitions of the organism, I say, can be reconciled by interpreting them as describing alternative realisers of a common functional role. Secondly, we should define the organism in terms of the mechanisms which play this role. Okay, so this is what we've got up next. So these are the ones I flashed up too quickly earlier. What I'm going to do is just focus on a couple of these to achieve my first goal, which is to show you that these aren't equivalent. So it's important that I persuade you that these aren't just different ways of saying the same thing. So if I'm going to impress you by unifying them, I have to show you first that they're not already saying the same thing. Okay, so first we can consider a sexual definition. So this basically says that an individual is the entire mitotic product of a sexually fertilised zygote. And I touched on this yesterday again. This was one that Huxley originated. So on this view, anything that's genuine reproduction involves the combining of genes from two parents into a single genotype. And then all forms of asexual replication, so propagation from cuttings, parthenogenesis or fission. These people want to say that that's actually just expansion or growth of a single individual. The bottleneck definition, on the other hand, this defines the individual as the entire mitotic product of the bottleneck stage in the life cycle, sometimes the single-celled stage. So in many species, the phenotype kind of shrinks down to a single cell each generation before ballooning back up again into the adult form, as Dawkins puts it. Now, the sexual bottleneck views quite often overlap, because zygotes are always single-celled, obviously. But one case in which they diverge occurs in these aphids. These reproduce by what's called cyclical parthenogenesis, which basically just means that the females clone themselves all summer and they reproduce sexually just once at the end of the season. So during the summer, most of what we call insects have been produced via single-celled bottlenecks, but in the absence of sex. So for someone like Janssen, who takes a sexual view, he would say that the whole clone is one organism with spatially separated parts. And as I think I mentioned yesterday, he argues that we shouldn't be misled by the spatial separation of these insects. He says that's not relevant. The insects are just like cells in the body of a cow. We can ignore them for evolutionary purposes, he says. So a demographer who takes this view is going to count the clones, but not the insects, separately. A supporter of the bottleneck view, on the other hand, is going to say that these insects are organisms because they've developed from single unfertilized eggs. So a demographer on this view is going to need to count those individual insects separately. And you might at this point just say, well, so what? Why does that matter? Well, my idea is basically that if there's selection taking place within those aphid clones, then it matters. So perhaps one of these aphids has acquired some sort of mutation and it's passing these on to its mitotic offspring. If there's any sort of advantage to that mutation, then the progeny carrying that offspring might do better than the others. They might produce more clonal offspring than the others within the clone. And the trouble is that the scientist who's measuring aphid fitness only at the clonal level just isn't going to see this. She's looking for evolution between clone generations, not within them. So she can potentially generate a slightly different figure for the total evolutionary change she's going to predict if she counted the insects instead of the clones. Okay? So there's cases in which these two demographers can end up with different empirical predictions. And in this sense, at least, at most one of those definitions can be right. You know, one of them's going to be worn out and the other won't be. And I think we need to find out which one it is, ideally. Now, one thing some people often think at this stage is that a genetic view might help. So you might just say, well, it doesn't matter, we don't need to count the organisms at all, we can just think about things from the genes eye view. But the problem is, this doesn't actually sort out the problem with the aphids, right? We can't actually count the number of allele copies contained in each aphid, because we can't count the number of cells in an aphid. And in fact, the genetic view isn't doing away with the organism concept at all. It's actually using it. It's smuggling it in the form of the assumption that each organism only needs to be counted once. And it's making some assumptions about the properties of those organisms that support that assumption. Okay. So, hopefully I've persuaded you that there are real differences between at least some of these views and that there isn't an easy solution here. So now I'm going to try and persuade you that some of these definitions have something really important in common, after all. These ones that are in red, to be precise. So I'm going to try and persuade you that these definitions in red are identifying mechanisms that all have a shared functional role or a common effect. This again is a kind of preview. So the common effect is that each mechanism causes selection to act at one particular hierarchical level rather than another. Or more precisely, each mechanism increases the extent to which selection is able to act at the between unit level relative to the within unit level. And I'm going to say that each mechanism does this by manipulating the extent to which objects at those different hierarchical levels have the capacity to exhibit heritable variants in fitness. I'll come back to this. Okay, so I think all of these views can be understood as homing in on a mechanism which influences relative levels of selection in some way or other. And again, I'm going to go through a couple of these to show you how the mechanisms they pick out bring about this common effect that I'm describing. It's easiest to see with a policing definition. So this says that something is an organism only if it has policing mechanisms whose job is to suppress lower level selection. So this is already a functional definition. It's just a kind of catch-all term for any mechanism which is suppressing selection within the organism, within the group. It's also fairly straightforward to see that the primary effect of the bottleneck is to reduce genetic variance within organisms. So this was Dawkins's idea originally. He says that basically all the cells in a mature organism, because they're copied from a single ancestor, they're more likely to be identical to one another than if they were copied from separate ancestors. This is supposed to increase the extent to which the different parts of the adult organism are genetically homogeneous. So Maynard Smith here explicitly says the crucial reason why competition between cells doesn't disrupt the organism is that typically development starts from a single cell, so that apart from somatic mutation, the cells of an individual are genetically identical. Now, the important thing about this is that genetic variance is one very important ingredient of heritable variance in fitness of selection. So by reducing genetic variance, a bottleneck reduces the potential for selection within the organism. It's slightly less obvious how germ-soma separation impacts on selection. There's a bit of ongoing controversy about this, I think. Though there is widespread agreement that it plays some sort of policing role. So Buss, for example, says that it's in virtue of eliminating or severely limiting the heritability of most of the cells in the organism that it succeeds in reducing the potential for selection within that organism. We can discuss that again later if you want. Sex is also playing a similar role. What this is doing is increasing genetic variance across organisms. So by creating a novel genotype for each offspring, it makes those offspring more different from one another. So it's increasing genetic variance at the between organism level. Spatial boundaries is another one that, again, I'm going over quite quickly, but spatial boundaries can basically increase the potential for selection between organisms by preventing their parts from mixing or by preventing migration across groups, if you're looking at it in group spectrum terms. I'll say a little bit more about immune response because it's slightly subtle. So this is an old idea that's kind of recently been revived by this guy Thomas Pradier. Immunity actually sort of plays a dual role in that it polices within the organism by kind of eliminating elements that might cause within unit competition. But it also plays a role in many organisms in maintaining between organism variation. So I think colonial ascidians offer a great illustration of this. So what you're looking at in this picture are marine invertebrates basically that spread laterally over the surface of rocks. And they quite frequently reach such high population densities that different lineages kind of end up bordering right on one another. So this bottom picture here has got seven different lineages depicted on it. There's little arrows here. Can you, I don't know if you can see that. The little arrows here pointing to the sites of founder polyps. So that's the first polyp within each lineage in each case. So when these two lineages meet and border on one another, there's two things that might happen. One of them is called vascular fusion. And basically, the two lineages join up and fuse, form a single entity that's actually got a shared circulatory system. And dotted lines show where this has occurred in that picture. The other alternative, on the other hand, is that a rejection occurs, which has happened here. So the asterisks that you can't see on there mark a barrier of scar tissue that's formed between those two lineages. And this basically happens because the ascidians have got an immune mechanism which allows them to instigate an inflammatory reaction which destroys the interconnecting blood vessels between the two lineages. So there's been some ideas about why they do this, and one is that they do it to avoid fusing with cheetahs. Because cheetahs have been shown to be able to dominate a colony after it's fused and get their genes copied into more than half of the offspring, so they take over kind of preferential reproduction. And it's a histocompatibility locus that's determining whether there's a rejection reaction. So I think this gives you a really nice illustration of how immune mechanisms can genuinely act to keep one organism separated as a distinct entity from others. But I want to come back again to this general idea, which is that all of these mechanisms that I've been talking about have some sort of common effect. So they're all influencing the level at which selection is able to act. And I think once we've got this common effect clearly defined, the idea is that we can define this mechanism functionally. Okay? So let's give a functional definition of what you might call an individuating mechanism. I'd say there that it's any mechanism which increases the potential for between-unit selection relative to within-unit selection. And then what we can do is make the possession of some kind of this, of some mechanism of this kind, necessary to being an individual. So we thereby treat individuating mechanisms as multiply realizable, which is a bit of a philosophical term. Does everyone know what? Okay. So.
Trying to define for us mechanism.
it is some, I'm prepared to be really broad about it, so some property or structure which has this effect. Developmental bottleneck. So what a bottleneck does by decreasing within unit variance, it decreases the potential for within unit competition.
My question is really simple because I see the definition as very conceptual. I'm pretty sure that this is applied to everything, but I would like to have an example where you say in this animal, this is the unit, this is the organism, this is what is outside of the organism. You see a very simple
okay.
example.
Yeah, in human beings, this is the organism. There are this is the organism in humans and all other high vertebrates, and there are loads and loads of mechanisms having this effect. To decrease selection within my body and to increase the likelihood of selection between me and other human beings. Some of the mechanisms that do that are my immune system, my bottleneck life cycle, my germ cell separation.
So the bottleneck is the zero in your case?
Yeah. Basically, it just means that lots and lots of different physical structures are able to occupy a single role, to play a common functional role. So, for example, you might say that money is something that's realised by coins and notes and zeros and ones in computers even. The idea is that we define money functionally by what it does rather than what it's made out of, or its particular structure. So, similarly, a single protein can be realised by multiple different amino acid sequences. So lots of kind of different arrangements of underlying stuff can nonetheless do the same thing when we define them functionally. So an important thing, an important advantage of using a functional definition is basically that it allows for different lineages to have evolved lineage-specific or idiosyncratic individuating mechanisms. So this means that, in addition to talking about human beings as organisms, we can think about whether the concept applies to other lineages which lack the mechanisms which are bringing about my individuality. So, the general point I want to make here is that in higher vertebrates, on whom a lot of the work that's been done on individuality has been focused, there are lots and lots of individuating mechanisms like the ones I've described that coincide and that all act to drive selection to the same hierarchical level. But there are other organisms, there are other lineages which lack some or even all of these mechanisms. If you're saying that an organism necessarily has a bottleneck and you turn to an organism that doesn't seem to have, or at least doesn't have a single cell bottleneck, then you're forced to start thinking that maybe there's no such thing as organismality in that lineage. But if you've got a functional definition, what you can do instead is ask whether there are different structures that are actually bringing about the same effect in this lineage. So just because it doesn't do it the same way that vertebrates do it, maybe it's got other things that are doing the same job.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
So how do you apply this functional definition to the bacteria?
I'm not sure actually, but I'm hoping people who know more about bacteria So, the idea is that with this functional definition, we can get a more general definition of an organism than by focusing on any particular trait. So again, in the same way that insects and mollusks and owls all have eyes, even though there's very different structures performing that role in each case, we can expect that different lineages that, you know, are very different from one another, have very different ways of life. Nonetheless, they might still be organisms. They might just have a very diverse range of structures or properties that are pushing selection to one hierarchical level rather than another. So I think different lineages can actually use different realizers to get the same effect. Okay, so the effect here is to just influence which hierarchical level has the scope for natural selection, which level is capable of exhibiting heritable variants in fitness. And these are some things which I think can have an effect on that at various different levels and in various different lineages.
What is AFV
in? Yeah. Oh, sorry, heritable variants in fitness.
What?
Heritable variants in fitness. Lewontin's idea. Do you wanna wait?
Short interfering RNA simply carries too little information to aid in any kind of individuation.
It just might be a source of variants.
Sorry?
Just might be a possible something which eliminates sources of variants between cells, possibly. But the thing is I'm not really committed to any of these. This is more what you're able to tell me than I'm able to tell you. These are just sort of suggestions. These are ideas I had about the sorts of things which, I don't know, which might have an effect upon the extent to which different things are able to vary from one another in ways that are heritable and which affect their fitness.
Could we explain one of the examples, for instance, scRNA or RNA transfer? Why is it an individuating mechanism? I just not thought about learning why the fact we have a single cell stage in the life cycle makes an individuation. But why would cRNA, a small interference RNA, be an individuating mechanism? This is an intracellular regulation. No?
The reason I put that up there was the idea that siRNAs can play a role in cleaning up viral DNA that makes its way into cells. But yeah, I mean, I'm very willing to take one or some of these off if you think it just can't do the job I'm saying.
Later on, where your counting protocol that could be consistent or that would allow you to test?
Yeah. It's gone. Stephen Jay Gould's sense?
Well, I'm interested in what your concept of individuality is. I mean, you mentioned heritable variants in fitness, which is a
question. So one way to say it is that a really important role that the concept of an organism does in biology is in reference to counting. And in a way, what I'm doing is taking that really seriously and saying, well, let's define the organism as whatever it is that we need to count. Let's make that counting role primary and just say it's an organism if it's the thing that we need to count. Maybe I should carry on a little bit more.
Yes, please, yeah.
And just sort of...
I have difficulty in hearing these questions. I don't know whether we can sort of... I mean, it would be helpful perhaps to have them said louder or with a with a microphone. But I really
sure.
Can't hear what's going on.
Right.
But maybe I should kind of...
One suggestion, in case there are other disturbances off your mind, please repeat the question.
Okay.
Okay.
But if it's a kind of general clarificatory thing, wait a little bit, because it might be on its way to coming clear, and I'm not sure. Okay, so what I've been saying is that if you give a functional definition of an individuating mechanism or a policing mechanism, instead of making particular mechanisms necessary to individuality, it gives you more lineage generality. It opens up the possibility that some weird life form does have something which is driving selection to one hierarchical level, and it's different from the mechanism that's doing it in all other cases. But nonetheless, it's there, it's doing the right job. So, one thing I'm saying about this view is that it's unified and to some extent vindicated those six original views. So there were actually tensions between those views. Maynard Smith and Buss, for example, were arguing with each other about whether a bottleneck or a James-Hermer separation is more important, is the thing that defines the individual. And what I'm saying here is really like a It doesn't matter. They're both doing the same job. They're both bringing about the same effect. You don't need to argue about which one is doing it. It doesn't matter which mechanism is doing the job, as just as long as something is doing it. So if you haven't got a bottleneck, or if you haven't got germ-soma separation, in my view, that doesn't mean you can't be an organism. It just means you need something else that's doing that same job. And the other plus point for this is supposed to be that by guaranteeing that the conditions for evolution by natural selection are satisfiable at the right level, i.e. by guaranteeing that there is the capacity for heritable variance in fitness at the level in question, thanks to the action of those mechanisms, we're guaranteeing that we always pick out the object that performs that desired evolutionary bookkeeping role. This is an important element of this schema as well. So I think that this functional view of individuating mechanisms makes one fact a lot more salient. A mechanism can carry out its function more or less effectively, more or less completely. And I think this is a really welcome consequence of this definition, because it's opening the way for individuality to be something that any collection possesses to a greater or lesser degree. So the idea is that we can equate the amount of between-pig selection relative to within-pig selection, which increases from left to right on that scale, with the degree of individuality possessed by pigs. Where, by the way, in pigs, it's very high. And again, this is just to vaguely point you at the idea, but the suggestion is that we could maybe, if we want to, equate the amount of between pig selection relative to within pig selection, which is increasing from left to right on that scale, with the degree of individuality possessed by pigs. And we could measure this quantity. I've demonstrated here how to measure it using Price's covariance approach, but I think it could be done with other measures as well.
What's your small gap doing with it?
I don't know if I want to get into this too much, but this is, so I've taken these terms from the multi-level, the partitioned Price equation, which tracks the covariance between traits, character values, and fitness, and partitions them into two components, which are often thought of as the between unit component and the within unit component. So that's basically saying, actually that's the wrong way around.
Yeah. There should be an expectation there in the denominator. May I just put it briefly, then we can discuss it later. Z is a trait value, so whatever, height perhaps. W is fitness.
It's probably not worth getting too hung up on that. So there's controversy about which is the best way to measure selection at different levels. And this comes from an equation, one of the equations, which gives you a way of doing that. But lots of people don't want to accept it anyway. So my account isn't tied to that as a particular measure in any case. So the thing I just want to say is that we do think we've got some way of measuring it. So it is a measurable quantity. And we can measure how much a collection of things has of it, and we can call that its degree of individuality. And by increasing this measurable quantity, the idea is that those mechanisms are increasing a collection's degree of individuality, which would be pushing it through an evolutionary transition. Now, at this point, I've got to admit that there are lots of things here on this slide that I haven't talked about yet. So I said at the beginning that this was a unificatory schema and I could bring all these views together. And those ones in red are all things that I haven't touched upon yet, okay? So this is where this diagram comes in. And so far, the only thing I've really talked about has been these, what I call mechanism definitions. Definitions which are pointing to a particular mechanism saying, this is, got to have this if we're going to call you an organism. And I was suggesting how we can unify them by describing them as just describing different realizers, different sort of physical manifestations of this single kind of functional role. I have also sort of touched on the idea that there's an actual quantity here that's being altered by the action of those mechanisms, or that can be. So we can think of the individuating mechanisms as bringing about a particular ratio between the selection at one level and the selection at a lower level. Another thing we can think about is possible consequences of this. So the possibility or impossibility of selection at one hierarchical level has lots of implications for the sorts of traits which can evolve at the level above, especially for altruistic style traits, which we take to be vulnerable to being undermined by lower level selection. So what I say in this schema is that these other views are basically best understood as just focusing on different elements of this causal schema. So some views are focusing on the actual amount of selection that's at the focal level, or the amount of selection that is allowed to occur at the focal level before we should call objects at those levels, at that level, organisms. So Gardner and Graffin, I don't know if any of you are familiar with that, but they say that we should only call something an organism if 100% of the selection occurs at the between organism level. So they make it a necessary condition that there is zero lower level selection. Compared to that, we've got a view like Queller and Strassman's that are just a bit more relaxed and just say there should be comparatively little conflict at the within organism level. So they're happy if there's some conflict. And then over on the right, I want to place all those views which are describing traits or properties that we think can only emerge once some sort of control of selection is already in place. So things like functional integration and division of labour, these are complex properties which again are going to be sensitive to disruption by conflict at lower levels. So the idea is that the emergence of these things therefore requires that lower levels of selection are already being suppressed. So in a way, I think that this schema enables us to unify all those different definitions, because we can basically understand those answering slightly different questions. So the middle ones are asking, well, how much selection? Mechanisms are talking about, well, how is that achieved? And on the right, they're kind of answers to, like, well, why? Why are these mechanisms driving selection up to that level? What are the advantages of it? So there are some key questions that are still remaining to be haggled over within this explanatory schema that I'm not going to pretend to answer today. So one, as I mentioned, is just like how much of the selection needs to be at that focal level before we can call the objects at that level individual organisms. And actually, I suggest that if you're willing to have a continuous view of individuality, you don't need to answer that. You can just say, well, it's got a small degree of individuality at that level, rather than having to make a sharp threshold. Another question which I've touched on concerns which metric or which statistical approach essentially we need to use to measure the amount of selection that's occurring at the focal level. So in other words, should we use Price's covariance method or contextual analysis or something else to decide how much of the total selection selective force is occurring at one particular level? And finally, which element of this process is definitive of individual organisms? Okay. I might stop. And has anyone got a pushing clarificatory question at this stage? Because I'm doing all right for time, and I'm going to move on to something slightly different. Go on.
So I was wondering, like something like a bee versus a hive. You could, in theory, think that bees have a different outer level of selection as much as the hive itself is, or the colony is. So in some sense you're saying that that both the levels, the amount of selection, you could compute for the bee versus the hive. If the bee tended to be higher than the hive, you would say the bee is the organism and the hive not, and vice versa.
Could you repeat the question, please?
So you said that to some extent a bee colony could be considered a unit of selection, did you say? And to some extent, an individual bee insect could be. What was the question?
Yeah, so is it just that if in some sense the individuating mechanisms will sort of identify the bee as being the having the highest amount of individual.
So what would my account say about this, basically?
Yeah, so it will just depend on that number which determine whether the bee or the colony is the individual.
So I think you're going to have to be more specific and talk about particular colonies. It's going to depend on things like the extent of reproduction by worker bees, which depends on things like the extent of worker policing of reproduction by those worker bees. If that policing is very effective, so that the queen is the only member of that colony that's reproducing, then I think the colony is 100% an individual, because there's no scope for those separate parts of that colony to exhibit heritable variants in fitness. There's no sense in which they can have independent evolutionary trajectories. Their fate, their evolutionary fate is thoroughly bound together. But where you have less effective worker policing and more reproduction by worker bees, that's going to undermine the individuality of the hive.
Could you make clear exactly what you mean by function? Because it has so many different meanings, and I think it would be helpful actually for you to spell it out.
Yeah, I mean in a really, really metaphysically unloaded sense. So it's a particular effect that I'm singling out as being important.
Just an effect?
Yeah.
I don't understand.
So I'm uniting lots and lots of different mechanisms by saying they all have the same effect. I don't think I need to start saying they were selected for that effect. It doesn't matter. They just all have that effect. That's what matters. Yeah? So it's not supposed to imply anything more. I'll repeat it. So he was just checking that I was serious, that some people think that if you've got something that's reproducing asexually, like the aphids were, that we should seriously think of the whole clone of spatially separated insects as being part of one organism. He said that flies so much in the face of common sense that it's hard to believe why I'd even take it seriously.
And your answer is?
My answer is that common sense has not featured as a criterion in my analysis at all. I don't really care about common sense. I've been trying to identify what concept can play the scientific role we want it to play, and I think common sense is often wrong.
No, I don't answer the question, because I wanted to make sure that we are in the same. Now, if you come to your definitions, the one that you propose as unifying, it is. Could you come back to the definition, because it's precise there. So you say that somehow. What defines an organism, the best way to define it is functionally by the criterion of individuating mechanism. Is this correct?
I wouldn't say I'm defining it functionally. I'm saying that an organism necessarily possesses individuating mechanisms, where this is any mechanism that has a particular effect.
Because is there not some circularity? Because you have... You define organism by individuating mechanism, but if you please come back to your definition of individuating mechanism, the between unit and so on. Now, there was something. Yes, okay. So you define individuating mechanism as a mechanism that increases potential for between unit related to within unit. How do you define unit? If you define that the unit is a whole species, then you could have also the same definition that applies, or the fetus, the colony, or the individual, or the cell. Is there not some circularity in the definition between you define organism on the basis of individuating mechanism? But then you need to define what is your unit in order to define the individuating mechanism. So if you say, my unit is the organism, you need to first define the organism.
Could you just summarize that briefly?
So your worry is that this is circular, because I seem to have unit or organism in the definition of the mechanism. So I'm taking for granted that there is a compositional biological hierarchy, and that what's going on when we've got these problems is that we're looking at that hierarchy and we're unsure which level of that hierarchy is the level at which there are organisms, is the level at which we need to count. So I'm presupposing that those levels are already there, that there's a few different candidates about the entity, the scale at which we could track the covariance between traits and fitness. I don't think that's circular in the sense of the definition. So basically a unit, it just makes the definition a lot messier to spell it out properly, but an organism is anything which possesses individuating mechanisms, where individuating mechanisms are decreasing the capacity of the lower level unit, the lower level things which are aggregated into that unit, which is limiting their potential to exhibit variance in the right way. So there's always kind of...
Carry on.
Okay. Okay, so for the last part, I was basically going to try and answer, say something about this question, and argue that, contrary to what other people are saying, it's this first box that we need to focus on. So it's the first element of this process which we should take off as definitive of individual organisms. So I think, while it's interesting to ask questions about the extent to which selection needs to be suppressed before certain traits can emerge and so on, I think the right way to define the organism is still in terms of these mechanisms, rather than directly in terms of the amount of selection at the relevant level, or in terms of the presence of any consequential traits at that level. Okay, so I'm going to argue that we should define the organisms in terms of these individuating mechanisms. Or in other words, I think we should give priority to the first box in this schema. I just plan to sort of say there's loads and loads of further things that could be said here, but I'm just going to make two main points. So first I'm going to give you one reason why we're better off defining organisms in terms of mechanisms than in terms of selection itself. So I'm going to give you one reason why we shouldn't use that middle box as the definition of the organism. Okay, so I think it's a mistake to suggest, as some authors have, that we should define an organism in terms of the actual amount of selection occurring at a level. So Gardner and Graffin and Queller and Strassman, for example, are arguing that that's the important property, is how much selection is occurring. And I've just got one reason why for this. So the thing is that there are various external and random reasons why selection could fail to act on a collection of organisms at any particular time. For one thing, it depends on population size and, of course, on the environment. So at some particular moment, it could easily be the case that we measure selection in something like a population of buffalo and find that there is no discernible selection happening between the buffalo for some of the traits. Equally, and depending on the method we've chosen for measuring selection, I don't want to go into that, it could appear to be happening when intuitively it's not. So it could happen by chance that we picked groups of humans in which all the variance is occurring at the group level rather than the human level. We could just happen to pick a group of humans that are homogeneous for the trait in question. If we defined the organism directly in terms of selection, it would actually be holding us hostage to these undesirable conclusions. We'd have to say then that selection is acting at the level of the group with respect to those humans, in a way that bringing mechanisms into the definition wouldn't. So in the case of those humans that happen to have the right trait, on my view, that wouldn't be enough to say that the whole group is an organism. There has to be some mechanism which is preventing those humans from exhibiting divergent fitness. It can't just be a matter of coincidence that they're all homogeneous for that trait. So a selection definition might say, might force us to say that if we can't see any actual between buffalo selection, that the individual buffalo aren't organisms. I can point out, however, that there aren't any mechanisms preventing there from being heritable fitness differences between the different buffalo. So therefore, it's still a level at which selection is possible. It still has that capacity. And then you can say, well, the buffaloes, they're not mere parts of a herd-level group. Likewise for the humans. So my general intuition here is that organismality, the property of being an organism, it's about the possibility of selection. It's about the possibility of parts of an aggregate having independent evolutionary fates. Referring to mechanisms and the definition of the organism allows us to focus on this potential or capacity for selection. Buffalo and humans are both organisms in virtue of the mechanisms they possess that guarantee that selection mostly doesn't happen within the humans, and that it certainly can happen between humans, regardless of whether or not selection is actually taking place at the moment that we're looking. And I was also going to have a quick look at a possible objection to my view that I'm calling the chicken and egg problem, which is again a sort of problem that's being discussed quite a lot at the moment by Gardner and Graffin and Sober and Wilson and people. Basically, the problem is that I seem to have certain traits on both sides of this schema. So bottlenecks, for example, are complex traits that seem like a possible consequence of or outcome of a process of higher level selection. But it's generally true that something can't be both a cause and a consequence of a process at the same time. So Gardner and Graffin say, you can't define an organism in terms of bottlenecks because they're features that have to be in place before so that the higher level organism exists. And Sober and Wilson are saying something similar. The organism needs to predate the higher level selection so that higher level selection has an object or a target. And I think the solution to this problem comes from letting go, again, of that idea that individuality is an all or nothing matter. So the thing which causes selection to act at the higher level, it's got to predate that higher level selection. And I agree that this does rule out complex adaptations, such as germ-soma separation. But then I can just say, but these are properties of very well individuated organisms. These are properties of organisms that are a very long way through the process of a transition, or a long way towards the right of the scale. And instead, we need to consider what sort of mechanisms might start this off, might push selection to the higher level at the very beginning of a transition, when there's no higher level individual at all, where all the selection's happening at the lower level. And I think we can think of the sort of mechanisms that can do that, that don't require higher level selection to get going. The third one I've written down is stickiness, but that's not a very scientific term, sorry. But the production of some molecule which is going to make the parts of an aggregate stick together is something I don't think you need to invoke higher level selection to account for. And it's going to introduce some sort of positive assortment between those particles. So it's going to some extent, drive the variants up to the right level to start calling it group selection. And you can see it as possibly having some sort of advantage if it makes the parts that are stuck together harder to swallow or something simple. We can at least imagine that you might have some sort of small degree of higher level selection at that early stage then. But my idea is that what you might then get is some sort of feedback process. So the initial appearance of higher level selection might be a byproduct of a trait that's advantageous at the particle level, but it can drive the subsequent increase in individuality by allowing for the higher level selection of mechanisms which suppress lower level selection altogether. And then eventually, but only after a long time when you've had this feedback process, then you might get complex mechanisms like germ-soma separation and bottlenecking to appear. And basically, as soon as you recognise a transition as a gradual process in which individuality at that higher level increases incrementally via positive feedback, I don't think there's a chicken and egg problem anymore. Okay, so I'm nearly done now. I was just going to briefly say how my account can answer the problems that I raised at the start. So I've already answered the first question by saying organisms essentially make good bookkeeping devices because they possess mechanisms which force selection to the right level. And they do this by influencing the extent to which objects at different levels can exhibit heritable variants in fitness. The second question was, what happens when organismality shifts during transitions? On my account, an evolutionary transition occurs when a collection of organisms acquires mechanisms which shift selection up to a new level, again, by manipulating the extent to which they can exhibit heritable variants in fitness. And one thing that we really mustn't forget of is that these transitions need to be gradual. They occur over evolutionary timescales. And this really implies that there have to be sort of halfway cases where mechanisms achieve only an incomplete suppression of lower level variants. And I think we can just say that these have got intermediate degrees of individuality. So finally, how can we decide what to call the organism in the tricky cases so that we can count them? My answer is just that we do that by searching for individuating mechanisms that allow us to say whether or not we need to count the objects at different hierarchical levels. Okay, so these are the main claims. Conflicting definitions of the organism could be reconciled by interpreting them as describing these alternative realisers of a common functional role, and we should define the organism in terms of the possession of mechanisms which play this role. That's it, so we've got plenty of time for arguing.
My concept or definition of an individual, somebody could help me rephrase it also, is that an individual should be understood as the basic unit of ego.
Sorry, can you start again? I missed the beginning of that.
Yeah, an individual should be understood as the basic unit of ego. Any single organism or a group of organisms having decided to live together with a single common ego is an individual. In case of a group, the job of ego could be either delegated to one of the organisms in the group, or there could be a group ego.
Are you saying eco or ego?
Ego. E-G-O.
What is
that? The I feeling.
I don't know what that
is. Okay, somebody could explain. The concept of ego is actually known for humans and many other animals. But I think work needs to be undertaken to either prove or disprove that plants and microorganisms and the so-called non-living things also have ego, and have a scientific explanation to the origin of ego.
Okay. Can you give me one reason why that's better than my account? What's the advantage of that over what I suggested?
When you say an organism as an entity of functionality, so it doesn't have an ego. But when something groups itself to attain its common function, you have something called an ego. You understand?
What do you gain by saying that, though?
See, whatever we are explaining now, it's based on what you say, the chemical reactions and all those things. We never go to the concept of the I feeling. Individual. When I say I am an individual, I have an I feeling.
So
okay, the organisms within me could also have an independent I feeling, but I am unaware of it.
So I think you're pointing to a property that you think is important about organisms that you think my account has missed out. Yeah. My response would be to basically place it in that last box. Sorry, I like putting things in boxes, and say that maybe that's the sort of thing that emerges at the right level once you've got selection under control. The thing that's important is that something, whatever this property is, it would be hard to have it at that level if there were constant selection going on at those lower levels. So it seems to depend on having mechanisms in place that have allowed that unit to carry on being a coherent unit through evolutionary time. So it might be one of these possible consequences.
Alan, your emphasis on individuating mechanisms, these are mechanisms, are they, that various degrees allow expression of Darwinian individuality, the opportunity for the entities to participate in the evolutionary process?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're trying?
Thank you for a very interesting one moment.
Okay, thanks again. I have one small comment to make and a sort of slightly different language in which I think one could formulate what you're saying. I perfectly agree with the proposal that you made that we should we could use the individual as a sort of bookkeeping mechanism in the counting tables of evolution. But then, say in a family of aphids which have been engendered parthenogenetically, each individual could again reproduce, and the rate at which the numbers would increase when you count each little aphid as an individual is different from that which you would get if you would count, you know, every family of aphids. So it does make sense to count the reproducing individual as the reproducing unit as an individual.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but I think something that would quite well express the final conclusions that you've presented would be to say that the individual is that which optimizes somehow the amount of information that is being passed from one generation to the other. Information that that is relevant to evolutionary processes. I mean, if you were to be able, if you were to copy all the mitotic mutations, somatic mutations, whatever, in the body of an individual and try to transmit all of that to the next generation, that would simply be disrupted. Whereas, you know, less information than that contained in the individual would simply be disruptive also. That would not be viable. It would not be enough to reconstruct that unit of evolutionary process, if you like. One thing that could be noted in addition to your conclusions would be that selection could very well operate at more than one level. So that if you have a collection of individuals that acquire individuating mechanisms, that one could very well envisage evolution at more than one level.
Yeah, I mean, so you said a few things. So on the last point, yeah, I intentionally mean that to be an explicit consequence of this. As soon as you allow degrees of individuality, you can have a degree of individuality at more than one level, which I think is often going to be what you're going to have to say about lots of plants, for example. In those cases, I think you're just going to need to use a multi-level modelling approach, or you're just likely to get something wrong. But can I just ask you, so you suggested that another way of saying this might be to say that the individual optimises the information that's passed between generations. So, as soon as you talk about optimising, I'm kind of...
No, there it is quite... there, optimization is taking place on just one very one quantity. Of course, it is again a large number of variables that go into defining or into computing that quantity, but it is something that is doable. I mean, the same kind of arguments have been brought to bear upon, for example, why the genetic code consists of four letters. Okay, that again is an optimization problem in the amount of information that you could with again, optimal fidelity pass.
Uh-huh. So, can I ask you sort of how well it maps on? Is selection at a lower level going to be disruptive to that ability to transmit information at the level? Okay. So by optimizing, it is in a sense saying that we need all the selection to be at the right level. It's kind of a because as soon as you say optimizing, I'm thinking that's quantitative. So it's asking this question about how much selection you need to be at the focal level. So it maps on quite nicely, in fact.
I like very much your idea about individuated mechanisms. The thing that I wanted to really try and reconcile was the ideas that come out of Ivo Diebe where, for example, the appearance of segmentation, for example, provides a lineage with a toolkit which enables it to speciate much more rapidly. And there it seems almost as though the lineage selection, which is what Steve Gould called it, is actually driving what then happens in the course of evolution. And I wonder whether you could put those things together with your ideas about individuation, because it seems to me it is actually quite important in terms of how transitions might occur.
So tell me again the first bit about segmentation.
Well, I mean, there's two thoughts here. Interestingly, both Steve Gould and Richard Dawkins, from very different positions, came up with rather similar ideas. I mean, Richard Dawkins had the idea of developing biomorphs, which could, he would put in developmental rules which would enable him then to select for forms and thereby could generate a whole variety of different forms. And what Richard found was that when, in his computer programs, he introduced a developmental rule which was to segment, produce a number of different segments in the individual organism, he could then actually generate much more variety than he could before. And in an almost identical way, although seemingly opposed, Steve Gould was making exactly the same point, that when developmental mechanisms first evolved to allow greater degrees of variation, that had a dramatic effect on the explosion of organisms after the Precambrian period. So, I mean, it's a very interesting idea that it crops up again and again in the evolutionary literature, that there are these kind of toolkits which then allow for whole lineages that are to speciate much more rapidly and take over the world.
So we're talking about evolvability here.
Yeah.
And various forms of modularity, such as segmentation, are supposed to enhance a lineage's evolvability. And what you might call a problem is that there doesn't seem to be any immediate advantage to the initial occurrence of a trait whose advantage is evolvability. So it seems like you have to postulate lineage or species level selection to explain why something like evolvability would increase.
Yeah.
May I interrupt here, just to clarify the question for myself? Is it the contention that there was selection for evolvability, or is it the contention that once something like segmentation arose, it immediately became, so to speak, evolvable? Not that that was the reason for its selection in the first place.
That's right.
Well, if that's true, then you don't need to call it lineage-level selection, I suppose. Call it regular organism selection. In a way, I feel like the question is kind of, what happens to species-level selection on my account? No. I mean, a short answer, in a sense, is that I haven't considered species level selection much. I'm generally thinking about a compositional hierarchy, and I don't really see species as going at the top of that. I see populations as going at the top of that. So in a way, I don't want to answer. I don't know. I don't have much to say about that. I mean, one thing that I think is an advantage of my view is that one thing I want to do is undo sort of emphasis that other people have been putting on genetic factors as being more important than any other factors. By talking about heritable variants in fitness all the time, there's room there for there to be lots of non-genetic causes of heritable variants in fitness. And I don't think that was the sort of case that you're describing, but there are cases in which you might have a group of entities that are completely genetically identical to one another. They might even remain genetically identical to one another, but they might nonetheless have some sort of heritable differences on which selection can nonetheless act. And this view at least leaves room for that.
Hi. That is actually really clarifying, because to me this is the right way to think about everything that you've said, is that you could essentially make a plot on which on the x-axis you had units, and going right down from genes all the way up to species or something. And on the y-axis, you had something like HVF. And then an organism in that view is simply the peak on that graph. So wherever the peak happens to lie is what you would call an organism. And therefore that gets rid of the circularity, because I think the impression that Jacques was saying about aphids and baby aphids, you could treat them as individuals rather than the organism. So at the level of level, you have the individual, which is just the level above the organ level, and then the species, which is above that. And all that you have is the distribution of HVF.
What's HVF?
The heritable variation of fitness.
Yeah, yeah. What is the y-axis? Just
yeah. So the y-axis is the HVF in a sense. The x-axis is simply all the units that you line up.
No. What he's saying is,
says that they're the only ones that matter, and your degree of individuality depends on having those three mechanisms. So my move to this functional definition says, look, stop getting hung up on particular mechanisms. It doesn't matter whether something's got germ, soma separation, tons of things haven't, and it in no way gives them a lower degree of individuality. I'd have differences of opinion with him about the degree of individuality possessed by certain cases.
But he doesn't. I mean, he talks about all the fuzzy areas, you know, germ, if you don't have a germ soma differentiation. He gives examples of sponges and so on, so he just puts those further down.
Well, he makes it fuzzy, but we still have, even if you accept that fuzziness, we'd still very much argue about whether something should be high or low on that graph, actually, because I think he just gets too hung up on particular mechanisms, and as I say, it doesn't matter what mechanism does the job, it's the job being done that matters.
Right, and again, from your perspective, just to be very clear, because I went somewhere else halfway through your presentation when you were asking about what's necessary for selection to act at the level, at a given level, which seems to me to be ignoring the fact that for selection to act at a given level, there needs to be an individuating mechanism. That's what you're saying too, isn't it? That actually, the question is not...
For sele- So, suppose you've got a population of particles. Particles.
Yep.
Neutral word. All the selection intuitively seems to be happening at the between particle level. The idea is that you might get some selections happening on subsets of those particles.
That would be dependent on those particles having some individuating mechanism. Or collective.
Where that individuating mechanism could be something like stickiness.
Yeah.
But I think stickiness itself, you don't need to start. There's no kind of circularity there, because stickiness could just happen.
Yes.
Yeah?
As this discussion indicates, the subject gives room for a lot of opinions that we have not explored. But would you tell us at least, for example, for me, a fertilized human is an organism, and a human being is an organism. Do you have any objection to that?
Yep. They're different temporal stages of an organism.
But the egg has not gone through all the things that you said that are necessary in order to define an organism.
It's got the capacity to vary from other organisms in ways that apparently affects its fitness.
But if you look at an egg of any species, you are assigning to these eggs a number of properties that you have not, let's say, analyzed. What this, for me, a bacteria is an organism, a single bacteria is an organism, and a single fertilized egg is an organism.
I don't understand what we're
so
disagreeing
about.
So,
you have no objection to that?
No. I don't think I understand why you think I would. I mean, the alternatives to calling a fertilized egg an organism would be saying that individuality is located at a different level there. So either the parts of a fertilized egg are organisms, or that the fertilized egg is a mere part of an organism, where the other parts would have to also exist at that time. And I don't see any candidates. Do you?
Yeah. This comes back to what I asked you previously about the common sense, because when I said common sense, it is what all biologists would consider as an organism, and indeed, I think that your definition must encompass bacteria and the fertilized zygote, but also the fully differentiated organism, so that's fine, you said that you're okay with this. And also, the fact that, for instance, plants are a very interesting model, because there is a qualitative difference between plants and bacteria, human, and so on. All these things are going to go down. And the bottom experience holds very well for animals. But in plants, for instance, there is no separation between germline and somatic cells. And so the level of selection is the organ, I mean, a branch of a plant. That can be a mutation in a branch of a plant. And then this mutation, this somatic mutation, will give rise to lobules and to germ cells that will be selected. And so this is a very interesting piece that should always be taken.
I didn't mention it today because I mentioned it the day before yesterday, and I've got a paper about it, so I just thought I shouldn't go over it again.
He wasn't here.
Yeah, I know. You're dead right. So, in fact, it was plants that gave me this whole idea. In looking at what's different between a cow and an aspen grove, and how to decide, you know, which... I don't know how helpful that is, but... trying to answer the question about whether an expanding aspen grove is the same as an expanding cow or not, I realise that the really important properties are somatic embryogenesis in plants. So the fact that, well, they're not really somatically differentiated, but that most and in some plants all of the different parts of the plant are able to differentiate into all the parts of the adult phenotype, basically means that they can reproduce sexually and asexually. And I think that, combined with the fact that you get high rates of mutation in these plants, and that in aspen at least you have various forms of physiological integration amongst parts of rammets and between different rammets, means that you've got to answer the question about what to count on the basis of how much those parts are able to have independent evolutionary lineage. If you identify a subpart of a module or a cell or a ramet that really can acquire a mutation and pass it on sexually or asexually, you've got to count it. You've got to call it an organism. If you don't, you're going to go wrong.
The fact that both secular and non-secular is a reproduction, you have it in the 18th as well. And there is really one more difference, which is the fact that somatic cells give rise to germs, and this is exceptional. Now, about the proposal to have a plot and to somehow measure what you propose, this, I see this as a proposal to quantify your criterion of individuation, this plot. I think it's very interesting because this opens the door to multi-level definitions of the organism. But you said tissue, and I have a doubt about tissue because differentiated tissues, cells do not produce anymore. So it will be included in your plot, but it will be at level zero because there is variability, but inheritance is zero. Except in plants, because in plants, mutations that occur in the differentiated tissue will give rise to it. So I think it's this might be very operational. But do I understand correctly that you could consider that, for instance, one human society is an organ that is made of organs and that
a human social group?
Here, a complete species or society as a tribe, for instance. You consider that the tribe is an organ?
No.
Why not?
Because humans are exhibit a lot of heritable variants of fitness from one another. Our fitness isn't coupled.
Could we have a last question now, please?
This is not a question, it's a comment. I'm very happy that I think we have converged on something like what Moynish drew, except I would start at cell, but at the gene level perhaps. The y-axis is just another name for information. I mean, I quantify variability very well by information cost.
What?
It's a function of variability.